So, but we will start our meeting, and we will officially call to order when we do have a quorum. As far as I can see, we're just going to go right down the agenda. We have House File 2339 Rosenthal, 2296 Metza, 2833 Draskowski, and 486 Garofalo. So with that, Representative Rosenthal, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
First of all, I would ask the question that I always ask is, is there anyone other than who's at the front table here that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill? Anyone with concerns? The department like to testify on this bill? Okay, certainly. So we will go to the proponents. I don't see any opponents. And then we will go to our favorite resource in the whole world, the Department of Revenue. Okay, with that being said, when we get the bill, please present it as amended, because yes. When we have a quorum, I will we'll have somebody move the bill and then move the amendment to get in the shape that the author would like. So welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 2339, Endow, Minnesota, would create a tax credit of 25% for contributions to permanent endowments held by community foundations. The purpose of this credit is to take advantage of a one-time transfer of wealth that's going to occur from baby boomers giving to the next generation. Based on the research of the Minnesota Council on Foundations from 2011 through 2031, when this bill would sunset, there's going to be a transfer of almost $50 billion. And we would like to capture some of that and keep it in our communities to do the good work that we're doing. Tax credit is primarily modeled on a similar credit in Iowa. It's been in place since 2005. The tax credit capture of 5% of nearly $50 billion of wealth would result in $120 million in new annual grant making and support tax-exempt groups around the state. In addition, North Dakota, Iowa, Wisconsin, Maryland, Indiana, and numbers of other states are either currently doing this or in the process of enacting such laws. This credit would apply to annual contributions of $100,000. So the maximum credit for any taxpayer would be $25,000. The bill proposes an annual cap of $4 million. In credits, it includes provisions to ensure that no single community foundation is able to benefit more than others. Also, I should note that the tax credit would sunset, as it already did, in 2032. It is estimated that 27 community foundations will be eligible to participate in the Endow Minnesota program. Most commonly, foundations have affiliates, subsidiaries that serve other committees. Taken as a whole, Minnesota's network of community foundations reach out through the entire state. And so that is really why I brought this bill, because it will do really great things for rural Minnesota as well as the rest of the state. And here to testify today is Chris Fulton. He's the executive director of the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation.
Thank you, Representative Rosenthal. We do have a quorum. I'll officially call the meeting of the House Tax Committee to order. Representative Schultz moves the minutes of February 28th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. Thank you, Representative Schultz. Okay, item next, Representative Marcourt moves House File 2339. Representative Marcourt moves the author's amendment, H2339A1. Any discussion on the amendment? To get the bill to the author would like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have the bill before us as amended. Now, again, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify with concerns about this bill? Okay. So please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Chris Fulton, Executive Director of the Grand Rapids Area Community Foundation.
Welcome, committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for this opportunity to talk to yourself and this committee about our community foundation and about the potential for this legislation called Endow Minnesota. I'd like to start with a little bit of background on kind of community foundations in general, and that will lead into a little bit of additional information about the impact of this legislation. So community foundations, and not knowing what the background is of the committee members, exist to promote philanthropy, to support donor choice, and to grow and support nonprofit communities. We're public charities, so we support public giving to create community good. The public aspect of it is actually a very important aspect of it. You hear about Bush, you hear about Blaine, you hear about all these private foundations, but we are really the community's foundation. Our philanthropists are community members writ large. Community foundations are defined by geography. So for me up in north central Minnesota, the greater Itasca area, really the wood basket for the Bland and Paper Company defines who we are. And I think the important point pertinent to this discussion is the point that all of Minnesota is covered by a community foundation that meets the stipulations to be qualified underneath this legislation. Importantly, the historic model, business model of community foundations is to build endowment for long-term betterment of communities. So speaking for our community foundation, we manage 137 different endowments. Each endowment takes a little bit of a different form. Some of these endowments are designed and managed for very specific purposes inside the community. Thankfully, some of them are designed and managed to be unrestricted to meet emerging needs. But, you know, I think 137 endowments makes us really the premier manager of endowments really in upper central Minnesota, which is a unique place to be. There's two types of endowments I would really like to spend a little bit of time with. I think that's where the power of this particular piece of legislation comes in. The first one are things called agency funds. Very simply, agency funds are endowments for nonprofit organizations. We manage 47 different agency funds in the Grand Rapids area, the Greater Itasca area. Here's the importance of agency funds. I mean, Grand Itasca Hospital, the Big Fork Valley Hospital. I could go through a list of the fairly larger nonprofit organizations in our town. All of their endowments are under our management. But the management of those endowments, along with our processes for general granting to nonprofits, puts us in a unique position and creates a unique relationship between what we do and what nonprofits do. And I'll tell you, personal experience, it's a very strong relationship. There's not a single nonprofit that I can't call out, speak directly to the director on a very personal basis. And so that's a very important thing. This particular legislation really connects, it really makes it easier for nonprofits to raise funds for their endowments. It's not easy to raise money for endowments. That's just coming from my short experience in this nonprofit world. But to be able to have a tool and an incentive to be able to do that is a very, very powerful thing. And, you know, again, 47 of the larger agencies up in our area have endowments that fall under us. The second thing I'd like to talk about are community funds. And we all have community funds. They're spread out across the state. We have five of them. I talk about one. It's the Nashwauk Area Community Fund. It's my favorite story. It's a long story, but I'm going to keep it short. I'm just going to say that when 80-year-old Marion Kumpula started the Nashwauk Area Community Fund back in 2000, she could never have imagined that at the end of 2017, 1,156 gifts would have come into this fund, totaling $690,000. That 105 grants would have gone out of this fund, totaling $180,000. And the current value of that fund is now over $730,000. Marion would just be flabbergasted about that. In Nashwauk, of all places, up on the Iron Range. This next year, that committee, our advisory committee, they make the decisions on grants, are going to get about $30,000 to apply against charitable nonprofit needs in the Nashwauk area. That's a significant thing for Nashwauk. There's two pieces of that, and it gets to partially to this generational transfer of wealth. In Itasca County, that number is projected to be about $530 million. If we could capture even a percentage of it, particularly through some kind of an incentive, think of the power of that. 5% comes to about $25 million that would stay in our area to do community good. The community foundation, a community fund provides the means for someone to leave a gift for their community. It's very hard to do that if you don't have something like a community fund. What happens up in Nashwauk is the youngster graduates from high school, and chances are better than not that they're going to have to leave. Chances are really better not that they're never going to come back. This generational transfer of wealth, what happens particularly in the communities that I serve is it's an outward flow. And so money that has been hard-earned in the mines and in the woods and in local businesses leaves these communities forever. Having an incentive and a tool to be able to keep some of that money in our community is a very, very, it would be very, very valuable. And in fact, it would keep a lot of these communities vibrant instead of not so vibrant. So I appreciate the ability to, Mr. Chair, coming and talking to your group, and I'll pass it off to my colleague.
Thank you. Please state your name and who represents for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Steve Jewell. I'm president and CEO of Community Giving.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Community Giving is an umbrella organization where we empower and support community foundations in the Brainerd Lakes area, Wilmer, Alexandria, St. Cloud area, as well as a number of other communities in between. I grew up in Jackson, Minnesota, down in the southern part of the state. I've lived in the northern part of the state, and for the past 20 years, I've lived in the greater St. Cloud area. And I've been working in this field of community foundations and philanthropy for almost 30 years now. And what I have to say in talking about community foundations in general is that I hope that you start to think about community foundations as institutions, institutions that are a vibrant part of the communities they serve. Because they haven't always been seen that way, but increasingly they are becoming that. Very briefly, I want to tell you the story about Vi Asherman. Vi Asherman and her husband Doc, who was a veterinarian in Wilmer, had no children, and they weren't sure what they were going to do with their estate. But they discovered that there was a community foundation up in St. Cloud, because there wasn't one in Wilmer yet, and so they talked to us about how they could structure their estate. After she passed away, the community received a $400,000 gift that was going to pay income to six different charities on into perpetuity to enable them to support wonderful causes. What that triggered was a group in Wilmer to talk about them having a community foundation. And they created this community foundation back in 1998. And this past year, they collectively raised over $1 million, the Wilmer Foundation did. And they brought together 3,000 volunteers in their community to revitalize the Robbins Island Park, creating a fully accessible playground for their community. Private money that came in, engaging the residents of the community, creating bonding between those people, and creating an incredible, incredible new park to revitalize Robbins Island. Many people think of community foundations and wonder how they're different from local United Ways. We often like to say that the United Way is a community's checking account. Money comes in, money goes out. Community foundations are really a community's savings account. And, you know, we have incentives in place to encourage us to save for retirement. We have incentives in place for us to encourage us to save for our children's education. And what we're asking you today is to think about incentives for communities to save for their future and enable private money to be able to make a difference in those local communities long into the future. And we have this brief window of time with this intergenerational transfer of wealth. Growing up in a small town in southern Minnesota, I've watched what happened to my hometown as small businesses are not as present on Main Street as they used to be. My father used to be one of those businesses. And so that intergenerational transfer of wealth, capturing that during this moment, is what community foundations are all about. And that's why we're here today. Thank you.
Thank you. Please state your name and your representative for the record, please, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeremy Wells. I serve as Vice President of Philanthropic Services at the St. Paul and Minnesota Community Foundations. I'm pleased to speak on behalf of the Endowed Minnesota legislation. Unlike Mr. Jewell, I grew up actually in central North Dakota in a small little rural farm town, but I'm proud to have been from Minnesota since 2004 now when I moved my children and myself here. And starting in North Dakota, you know, I've spent my career in philanthropy in the fundraising profession, working at various nonprofits, still serve on one of the boards at my alma mater, the University of Jamestown, and have seen firsthand the impact of the North Dakota tax credit on that institution and so many other nonprofits of the community where I'm from, where my parents live, where I did my undergraduate work, so on and so forth. Today I'm representing the St. Paul and Minnesota Community Foundations, and on one hand, the St. Paul Foundation, which is the largest community foundation in the state, as well as the Minnesota Community Foundation, which serves the entire state of Minnesota, the only statewide community foundation in Minnesota. As Chris mentioned earlier, we also represent 17 community funds. These look and feel very much like community foundations. They're just scattered around the state. And so we have 17 of these communities that are doing incredible work through this community fund relationship we have, and we're able to provide all the backstopping, all the services, give them access to investments and returns they simply couldn't get on their own, and give them that infrastructure to make sure that their number one priority is caring for their community, not how are we going to manage these resources, how are we going to do this or that. So we have community funds in Hibbing and Chisholm. We have community funds in Albert Lea and Fairmont, in New Ulm and Waseca, and 11 other communities scattered around the state. We do serve all of Minnesota. Last year, between our community foundations, our network of foundations, we granted almost $100 million out of our funds into nonprofits scattered around the state of Minnesota. 36% of the grants that were made from our donor-advised funds went outside of the 7 metro county area, out to greater Minnesota. We not only through these community relationships we have with our community affiliates, but we have donors that might live here, but they appreciate the ability to give to their hometown. Whether that's in Benson, Minnesota, or up on the Iron Range, or wherever it happens to be, we have donors that have connections to all these communities. We made grants to 67 out of the 87 counties in Minnesota last year. So we do have this reach out to greater Minnesota. We also manage nonprofit endowment funds or agency funds. So many nonprofits are in a position where they would benefit from some long-term charitable capital. But as Chris mentioned earlier, there's not access. That type of capital is really difficult to raise. We manage over 300 nonprofit endowment funds totaling nearly $200 million for nonprofits big and small, some as low as $25,000, others well up into the millions of dollars. And that's another way we benefit the nonprofits in the community. The last thing I want to say is that one of the things I heard growing up, one of the things I've experienced since I've been in Minnesota, Minnesota is built on strong traditions of giving. That's on the individual side, certainly on the corporate side, on the foundation side. I serve on an international board with colleagues from around the state, around the country, and internationally. Everyone's envious of Minnesota. They point to us and say, you've really got this philanthropy thing figured out. People are generous. People are giving. We've done a wonderful job over the years, and I think through this legislation, as Steve mentioned, in the incentive to save for the community's future, we have an opportunity to again be a leader, as well as some of our peer states have already done, as opposed to waiting for more and more states to get ahead of the curve on this and missing out on some of this important generational transfer of wealth. So I appreciate the opportunity, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to testify on behalf of this.
Thank you. So you're a Jimmy.
What? I am a Jimmy.
You're a Jimmy, all right.
Yes, undergrad.
For you up in the... Well, it's not for you. I'm going to keep it.
But there we go.
I got a Jamestown hat.
Excellent.
Questions for members. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've got a couple of questions, one for Mr. Michael and one for Representative Rosenthal. So I think I heard it, but I'd like you to just validate. People who give to this can impose a covenant on the gift so that it's used in conformance with a purpose or a cause that they would support and not used for something they don't. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, that is my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the other question is, they can give this gift while they're living as well as a matter of an estate issue.
Representative Rosenthal.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. It's an innovative idea. My question to Mr. Michaels is, you know, this imposes the opportunity to use a credit, which is much more powerful than a deduction. And I'm wondering what other tools people have at present to give. Are there any credits available in any other under current law that you're aware of, or is it strictly limited to a deduction which would have the benefit of their marginal tax rate? And I'm just wondering if you could comment on that.
Mr. Michael? Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertas, Minnesota has a variety of tax credits, but none of them for charitable contributions. So many other states do have, as the testifiers have indicated, a variety of different credits for charitable contributions, and there have been proposals in the past in Minnesota for specific things, but so far none have been enacted.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, this is an interesting concept, but I'm trying to get my head around what we mean by community. One of the testifiers referenced central Minnesota, the Brainerd Lakes area, and there you have Brainerd Community Technical College. I assume, because I think virtually all of our colleges and universities have a foundation. So if a resident of the Brainerd area chose to exercise this by making a contribution to the foundation at the Technical Community College, would that be eligible? And I don't know if that's a question of you or staff, but just, you know, the words community could be interpreted a couple of different ways, and there's references here to various statutes, and I don't know if a higher ed institution or a school district. I'm a retired teacher, and the school district that I worked for had a foundation as well, and that was K-12 district. So if somebody could comment on how limited or how broad this particular language is.
Mr. Michael or Mr. Williams? Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, the definition of the kind of community foundations that qualify requires them to support broad-based charitable interests. And in the bill, it's in the definitions in paragraph B. I think this would not be intended for a foundation that or a charitable entity that supports a very specific or narrow kind of thing. But the testifiers can obviously talk more broadly to what their intent is. But to me, it appears that it has to be much more broad-based than something for one educational organization.
Sir,
so
please state your name.
Steve Jewell, Community Giving, and we administrate and work with the Brainerd Lakes Area Community Foundation specifically. And in the case of Brainerd Lakes Area, a donor could very easily make a gift designating the end beneficiary off of the income stream from the endowment to be the Technical and Community College up in the Brainerd area. And so could the school. In fact, the Brainerd School District does have an endowment and fund which is already administered and partnered with the Brainerd Lakes Area Community Foundation. So it's a way in which community foundations partner with the other educational institutions or nonprofits to enable people to make gifts to wherever their passions lie and wherever they want to make a difference.
Chair Carl.
So, Mr. Chairman, then in essence, you would be the pass-through if there was a need for a student at Brainerd Community Technical College. Using that as an example because you're at the table. But when we say charitable, I know some of those foundations on our college campuses have helped students in a variety of ways. Typically, you think scholarships, but sometimes it might be an emergency situation, a battery for an automobile or a new tire or whatever, and that becomes vital for them to be able to commute. So I would define a lot of those usages as charitable in the broadest sense. But I understand what you're saying. If you wanted to give to Brainerd Community College, exercising this, if you gave to the Brainerd Community Foundation, you could put a tie on that's where it would ultimately go. So that basically answers my question, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And the endowment for the Jamestown Jimmies is $36.1 million.
That sounds correct, Mr. Chair.
Chair Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Rosenthal, for bringing this forward. And a question for one of the testifiers. With the new federal tax law and the increase in the standard deduction, there will be less itemizers. And so I guess, have you looked at, and it probably wouldn't affect the big donors, but the smaller donors, have you looked at what impact that may have on your contributions because of the charitable giving?
Mr. Wells?
Yes. Thank you, Representative Marquardt. We have looked at that. We look at it very closely. You're right, for the largest donors, the anticipation based on the study done by the Lilly School of Philanthropy out in Indiana is that the number of itemizers would drop from roughly 27 to 30% down to maybe as low as 5, somewhere between 5 and 11%. We're hearing from a lot of individual donors and professional advisors that are stating they're encouraging their clients to bucket or cluster their charitable contributions, maybe make 3 times the amount in 1 year and then take the standard deduction the following 2 years. So they will likely still give, I think, at increasing levels. They might just do it differently based on how the tax code is currently written, the new federal tax law. And so none of us know is probably the most appropriate answer, but we're definitely working with nonprofits, working with our own donors to help identify what are the best strategies under the new auspices of the tax law to continue to encourage philanthropy. For those that don't itemize, this would certainly still be an opportunity for them to take a credit, which is not dependent on whether or not they take a charitable tax deduction. So This could actually be an extreme incentive for those people that are choosing not to itemize because maybe they were in that bracket where they're right on the edge. It might not make sense for them. They might take that doubling of the standard deduction instead.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And this, Mr. Chair, as we've discussed, is probably going to be an area we'll have to look at as we consider the conformity and all. So, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm kind of interested in on page 4 where it talks about the limit on the amount of tax credits that the commissioner can give out. What happens if the total contribution credits total over $4 million? How do they determine who's not going to get it, or is it prorated, or what? Is there any thought about that? I'm just curious.
Representative Rosenthal, is it first come, first served? Mr. Michael? So after I give, there's not going to be a whole lot.
Mr. Chairman, yes, the mechanism in the bill is a first-come, first-served allocation, but there are limits on, there are maximums on the amount that any one taxpayer can get and what any one organization can get. And the way the mechanism works is that the contributor applies to the Department of Revenue to get a certification, and then they have 60 days to make their contribution, and if they fail to make it within that 60-day window, then their certification expires and it would be available to someone else to make a contribution.
Okay. Mr. Wells.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that's also written in a way that there's an 8-month holdback on the credits to encourage availability for smaller donors as well, so it's not just a whole bunch of individuals coming in with $100,000 contributions and taking the majority of the credit. These would be contributions of $30,000 or less, and so it's intended to encourage philanthropy at all those levels, not just at the highest level.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg?
Aye.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's an interesting idea. And to me, though, the question is, since we know that with the federal tax changes, our corporations and businesses have gotten more tax relief and tax cuts than anyone else, and I'm wondering, and individuals, depending on where their family circumstances are actually potentially going to be paying more. So I'm wondering why we wouldn't target this first at donations from individuals rather than broadening it to any entity that pays taxes. And all of your stories were about individuals, and I understand the interest in incenting that. But it seems to me that the corporate and other incentives are already there in other ways to have tax relief, and the connection is more the individual to their community. If you might address that.
Yeah, Mr. Jewell?
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler. Honestly, as a community foundation, we support this bill. We think it'd be a great incentive. But it may need some changes. If we work with individuals, and in fact, we always also like to say you don't have to be a multimillionaire to be a philanthropist. So our focus really is we've watched teachers and people coming from all means and backgrounds set up endowments for the benefit of their community. And so to us, I know as our community foundation, we're not beholden to having it be specifically for corporations and if it could benefit and we could get this passed because we focus on individuals, we'd be all for it. we'd be all for it. So, and I agree with you. We in large part work with individuals. We don't work with corporate entities for the most part. Our focus is on individuals. We do some partnerships with corporations in their corporate giving because they can do it more efficiently sometimes through a community foundation. But our focus in large part is 90% is individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And outside of this room, I will follow up just because about the accountability of these community foundations and the oversight, because in my community, I know of one person who was a clerical worker, started with a company that became big, huge, was paid with stock holdings when they couldn't make payroll at the beginning. And this person, when they died, left over $20 million endowment to a particular foundation, which then spent it outside of the community in which she spent her entire life. And I've known many people who knew this person who were totally surprised at the choices that were made. And so I think we just need to make sure that we have the oversight that the intention of the donor is met, particularly if we're going to be giving tax incentives and encouraging more and more individuals to step up.
Thank you, Representative Loffler. Chair Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Representative Rosenthal. Kind of looking over this, I get the impression that you view tax credits as something to a change of an individual's behavior. Would you say that's the case with this bill that you're looking to do?
Representative Rosenthal.
Or to at least influence their behavior, I should say.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Anderson. You know, this generational wealth is a one-time opportunity, and we're looking at the best way to capture as much of this money to keep it in our community as possible. And we came up with the idea of a tax credit would be the most valuable tool to get the most money for these foundations.
Chair Anderson. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any limitations on the purposes of donations to community foundations under Minnesota statute?
Mr. Wells.
Representative Dabney, just a clarification. Currently, are you asking specifically about this bill?
Mr. Chair, sir, currently.
Currently.
Mr.
So,
Wells.
Yeah. So if someone makes a contribution to any community foundation, they could set it up for a specific purpose regardless. It could be I could set up something at the St. Paul Foundation, for example, to benefit the University of Jamestown, which sits in North Dakota. I think the intention of this bill is that it would have to be restricted for purposes of benefiting Minnesota or communities in Minnesota. So that type of endowment would not be eligible for this kind of a tax credit.
Chair Dabney.
Mr. Chair, thank you. So anything that I as the donor deem to be to the benefit of the community is eligible?
Mr. Wells.
Representative Dabney, as long as it's a charitable purpose. So out of a community foundation, we could support, as long as it's benefiting a charitable organization, charitable purpose within a community. You know, we couldn't grant to for-profit organizations that are doing important work there because that's outside of the auspices of grants coming out of a community foundation. But, yes, as long as it's a charitable purpose, regardless of cause, it could be education, environment, health care, human services, jobs, whatever it happens to be.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to thank Representative Rosenthal for carrying this bill. I am worried about the tax implications of the new tax bill and how that's going to affect charitable donations. I just have one question. How did you land on the $300,000 limit for donations of $30,000 or less to be set aside? And why $300,000? Why not a greater amount?
Representative Rosenthal.
Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, it is a number that we thought was a good place to start. It doesn't have to stay there. It can move. But we wanted to make sure that the small donors did have access to some parts of the fund.
So if you realize that you're getting more smaller donations, you'd be willing to increase that and set aside more money?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Representative Schultz, absolutely.
Representative Schultz. Chair Grafflo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just really quickly, I always think it's important to remind members of the committee, particularly my good friends on the DFL side of the aisle, that when I hear them talk about businesses and corporations paying taxes, a reminder that businesses do not pay taxes. Businesses collect taxes. Businesses are a tax agent for the government. Whatever taxes we impose on those businesses, they simply pass on to their consumers and their other providers. So, reminder, businesses don't pay taxes. They collect them.
Okay. So, with that, we will thank you, gentlemen. We will go to Representative Blesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Chair Garofalo, thank you for that great reminder. You may also want to remind the chamber and all the businesses that come here in front of our committee to lobby vociferously to reduce their taxes, that they really should just go home because they don't pay taxes anyway. I hear that consistently being said from companies that they don't pay taxes. And Chair Lencheski used to say that once in a while as well when we were talking about the corporate franchise tax. But I guess as an old prosecutor, I tend to look at where the motives are, and there's no question. There still is incentives for them to reduce their taxes because they're still responsible for setting their prices, and I don't think it's a direct pass-through, Representative Garofalo.
Representative Garofalo, your name was used. Okay, thank you. With that, we will move on here. Let's go to, there was somebody that had concerns, I believe, that is against helping communities raise money to help their people as best they can. And remember, members, like I say, don't give till it hurts, give till it feels good. Oh, yeah, please state your name and who represents the record, please, ma'am.
Good morning. That was quite an introduction. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I work at the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you so much for having me this morning. I just want to start out real quick by clearing something up that deeply support communities, deeply support community foundations, support endowments as an incentive and a mechanism for donations. The Minnesota Council of Nonprofits has over 2,000 members across the state, 6 regional locations. We reach about 20,000 nonprofit employees specifically, and that includes all 501c3s. That includes nonprofits that you might more traditionally think of. It includes community foundations. It includes churches. It includes schools. These are members of the Minnesota Council of Nonprofits. So we share the value of our friends that were here testifying today, that that there does need to be a positive giving climate, and we agree that it should be characterized by incentives for charitable contributions. Where we have a slightly different opinion is we believe that all donors and contributions should be treated equally, that we shouldn't set policies that send a signal that some types of giving or particular types of organizations are more valuable and worthy than others. So, for instance, somebody who wanted to donate $4,000 to this school would not be eligible for this tax credit, and so then their donor intent would not be respected under this. And so while we agree that there is an important opportunity to consider transfer of wealth, that's a really important conversation to have, this just isn't the right strategy. With everything going on with the federal tax bill right now, we would respectfully request that prioritizations are given to expanding charitable deductions, which achieves the goal of encouraging more donations for everyone and for every level, including endowments at charitable foundations.
Thank you for your time. Sarah, and thank you for the representing the nonprofits as you do. I've worked with your groups before.
Yeah,
on some pretty interesting cases. So thank you for all you do for our community.
Thank you, Chair Davids.
Thank you. Okay.
You're on.
Okay. Thank you. Seriously, thank you. Questions for members for Ms. Lucero? Okay, thank you very much. Points well taken. Okay, the department.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rosenthal.
May I just say something quickly?
Certainly.
You know, these foundations are part of the organization that we just heard from, and we've had talks with them, and you know, there's nothing stopping them from setting up an endowment as well.
Thank you. Please state your name and who represents the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenthal, and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue.
Welcome to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chair, yesterday I provided some congratulations to you on your birthday, Mr. Chair. Today, it is Representative Rosenthal's sort of birthday. And so I brought treats for, it went so fast that I think we all missed it. But, so here's some treats for Representative Rosenthal's birthday.
And it's Representative Detmer's birthday. It's Representative Detmer's birthday, too.
Oh, well, Representative Detmer.
Now, to the page, just so you know, you're new here, all of those things start here. So, I just want to clear that up for you. Just here to help.
I was able to talk to Representative Rosenthal last night about this bill.
Mr. Chairman, I thought it should start by seniority.
A Republican.
You were quick.
Now, in the spirit of bipartisan compromise, give this one to Chair Carlson.
We're off to a good start for the legislative session.
Yes, we are. Ooh, man, now, just a second here. We got to take a brief time out. One of each.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenthal.
Just for the record.
Well, it's your birthday.
My birthday occurred sometime between yesterday and today.
It did. You know, really, he should get these first.
No, no, no.
I call this.
That means you're like six.
Oh, just wait. You're like. Seriously?
Oh, he's got
Well, that's special. Want me to carry the wire wheel?
Yeah, I do. That one's coming down.
Okay, we have to have our priorities straight here. Okay, let's get some cookies out here. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you for having a birthday. And Representative Detmer, thank you for having a birthday. And, of course, you, Mr. Chairman, turning 59 and a half.
59 and a half. And in 3 months, it'll be 59 and three quarters.
Yes. Okay. Mr. Cummings.
This bill provides a 25% non-refundable tax credit for charitable contributions to endowment funds of community foundations. The credit requires a minimum contribution of $5,000 with a maximum credit of $25,000. Credit applies to individual income, corporate, and insurance premium taxes. And then, as you've heard, it's limited to $4 million a year. This proposal would provide a tax credit for contributions to endowments that would not be available to nonprofits. Some of these endowments may subsidize smaller nonprofit organizations, but if the intent is to assist these organizations, this proposal does not provide a direct method of doing so. This proposal may lessen charitable gifts to nonprofits that are not qualifying foundations, since the tax benefit for giving to foundations would be considerably larger. There will be taxpayers that previously gave to nonprofits that shift the donation to qualifying foundations. It is unclear to what degree this proposal would increase charitable giving in Minnesota. This proposal would provide the most benefit to taxpayers that already donate to foundations. They will receive a tax benefit for behavior they're already engaging in. The goal is to change behavior. This may not be the most efficient way to do that. In addition, this 25% credit will essentially go to the programs from the decisions made by the endowments. If Minnesota wants to subsidize important programs across the state from taxpayer dollars, then we should consider directly appropriating the money to programs that are prioritized by the legislature and governor. The bill also has a requirement that any contribution must be at least $5,000 to receive the tax credit. This significantly limits the number of Minnesotans that could benefit from this credit, since only a limited number of wealthier taxpayers can make a donation that large. If increasing donations to foundations is a goal, a $5,000 minimum may not be the most effective way of doing so. We look forward to working with the committee and staff to discuss other drafting ideas that could clarify the bill. And if this bill moves through the process, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Representative Rosenthal, and staff. We thank you for the opportunity to be a resource.
So you're a resource today.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you. Okay, any questions for the department, Mr. Cummings? Thank you for your statement, Mr. Cummings. You want to wrap it up? Any other questions for Representative Rosenthal? Otherwise, we'll have him wrap it up here. Okay, why don't you give us your closing comments, sir?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This is a unique opportunity to capture a generational transfer of wealth. We're talking about somewhere in the vicinity of $50 billion. And what this would do would capture some of that money to our nonprofits, community foundations, to actually build and help maintain the community where the money was made. And this is goes throughout the state. It's being done in Iowa. We think we can build a fund up to about $127 million. And I just think that it's a unique opportunity, and it's a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, and it does sunset in 2032. And I would ask for the committee's support.
Okay, thank you very much. With that, Representative Marquardt renews his motion at House File 2339 as amended be later for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Rosenthal, and to all the witnesses. Good discussion on a very important topic here. So thank you,
Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Okay, item next, Representative Metza. Representative Metza moves House File 2296. Representative Metz, is that your amendment?
It is, Mr. Chair.
Representative Metz moves the H2296A1 amendment to get the bill in shape to author like. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. We now have House File 2296 as amended before the committee. To the bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, essentially this bill started a few years back in my first term here, and the vision of it was we had had a few issues with the MPCA and DNR not being able to talk to one another as efficiently as they could have. And in regard to the permitting process, I think we can all agree that we want those agencies communicating to make sure that our state employees are crossing the T's and dotting the I's that need to get done and to provide it in the most efficient fashion. So what this bill did is allowed those new hires that were appropriated out of the dollars that we passed to work together in an interagency fashion. And over the last few years, it's been an important tool, both in the taconite and in the non-ferrous mining industries, as well as, I'm sure, other permitting areas. In specific right now, what we've run into is the 2.5 cents per ton that was dedicated fell short of the actual cost of hiring some of these full-time equivalents. And in order to kind of stabilize that out, what we did is inserted a floor at the $1.1 million level that you see in the language. And there was also an effective date change at the end, which was incorporated in the amendment. So essentially, this would help get one full-time staff now, in addition to what they've already done, up in Hibbing and working. And I would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Representative Metz. So before we go to that, is there anyone here to testify on behalf of the bill or a resource? Is there anyone against, or excuse me, we're not against things. We have concerns about things. Is there anyone with concerns about this bill? Okay, Representative Metz, I think you know what that means. Does the department wish to testify on this bill?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Okay, so there's no one with concerns, so questions for the author. Did you want the gentleman to testify? Or?
Yeah, that would be great, Mr. Chair. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Henderson. I represent Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. I work in lands and minerals.
Welcome to the committee, sir.
Thank you. I am a manager in permit coordination, and I work directly with the staff that have been hired from these funds. The DNR does support this change in language. These funds have allowed us over the last few years, as Representative Metz has said, to have some shared resources with the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency and use those resources on critical path issues. The flexibility that it allows has been very beneficial for us. It allows us to try and put the right skills at the time of need in the agency that we need them to help reverse slowing of the regulatory work in the mining areas. It's allowed us to hire hydrologists, permit writers, wetland specialists, project managers. You know, we have rigorous environmental review and permitting programs, and having these technical experts has been beneficial. The current structure, as Representative Metz said, allows for yearly changes and balances in the money, and having this floor would allow us the stability to hire the additional person that we have heard from the mining community that they see as a current need. It's a wetland specialist right in the Hibbing office that would be available, on shorter call to be on site and to do inspections and do some of the work that they're saying is critical in moving some of the permitting projects and environmental review projects forward.
Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Questions for members for Mr. Henderson? Okay, thank you very much. You want to wrap it up, Representative Metza?
Well,
Is there a question? I'm sorry, Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Chair Davids. Hey, Representative Metza, can you remind the committee why the benefits of having an occupational tax in lieu of a corporate franchise tax?
Representative Metza?
I would leave that, I think, Representative Schultz, to research, yes.
Mr. Michael? To the Schultz question.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Schultz, first of all, the Constitution of the state requires the legislature to impose an occupation tax, so there is that, but that's simply a matter of nomenclature. The occupation tax itself is calculated in a way that's based on sort of a synthetic measure of income, and so it does not essentially get incorporated on a combined report basis with the steel makers that in some cases in the old days used to always own the mines, and in those circumstances it had the effect of, and when I say on a synthetic basis, basically you look at the mine and you look at the Lake Erie price of the ore and you allow certain deductions and calculate whether or not they have income and apply the corporate franchise tax rules to that income, as opposed to saying, how much of your mining operation that's part of your vertically integrated steelmaking, how much of that is really attributable to the mine? It's very difficult to do, and so I think, for decades, over a century, we've had this system that sort of says we're going to calculate a sort of a synthetic rate of return on the mining part of it, of the operation, and impose our tax on that. That won't be as much affected by the rest of the integrated steelmaking. Now, as things have changed over time, we now have a mining industry that's not as integrated as it was, so that it's, U.S. Steel is still a case like that, but Cleveland Cliffs, to, take the other big producer up there, is just really a mining company, and so maybe you could actually go away from that, but I guess the simple answer is it was a way to isolate the income from mining from the rest of those steelmaking operations so that the tax would only apply to the mining operations, and that requires sort of separate synthetic income calculations.
Thank you for that history.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Okay. Questions for Mr. Henderson or Representative Metza? Thank you very much. You would like to wrap it up, Representative Metza?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just add that we are hearing from some of the mining companies that a more integrated approach might be more appropriate again in as we move in a competitive global market. And so I think keeping our options open in regard to how we're collecting these and making sure that our companies can be thriving and having less ups and downs as the global market affects our prices here and saleability. And we look forward to the news today from President Trump on some of the decisions on the steel tariffs, and I'll close with that. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much. So Representative Metzer news is a motion that House File 2296 as amended related to possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you, Representative Metzer. Thank you, Mr. Henderson. Okay, item next, Representative Drazkowski. Representative Drazkowski moves House File 2833. I do not see any amendments. Do you have any amendments, Chair Drazkowski?
I do not, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Please introduce your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, House File 2833 focuses on tip income, and what it would do is provide a subtraction for tip income from the Minnesota income tax. Members, we are finding ways and looking at ways to help encourage our economy and encourage our younger workers and our beginning workers. This is one way to do it, and so I wanted to bring this forward as an opportunity for us to provide that incentive for people as they get going in the workplace. With that, Mr. Chair, we have Xavier Bickett here to talk about the bill further.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Yes, my name is Xavier Bickett, and I guess you could say I'm here to represent about 100,000 people who roll up their sleeves and work in Minnesota every day. And as Representative Drazkowski mentioned, this is an opportunity that we have to help the working class earn more money. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, this is from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, the Tax Research Division, on August 14th of 2007. This is going to affect about 99,000 taxpayers. And not only that, but according to their statistics, it's about $2.3 billion of wages. And if you kind of average that out, this is going to be affecting people kind of in the lower class that earn about $23,469. So this is going to put more money in the pockets of those people that are working every day. And this is, when we talk about tax cuts and trying to help people, this isn't for CEOs or top-level executives. These are the people that are working, according to Bureau of Labor Statistics, people that are restaurant servers, bartenders, counter attendants, coffee shops, barbers, hairdressers, people that do pedicures, bellhops, taxi drivers, people that work for Uber. I have a few stories that I can share with you of, you know, kind of the people that this would be affecting. I talked to Abdi, he's an Uber driver in Minneapolis, and we talked about this. Like, how would you feel if you got to keep more of your tips? He said this would be great. You know, he drives in Minneapolis for Uber at night so that his wife can watch his kids during the day, and this would just help put more money in his pocket. Annie, who's married in Bloomington, you know, this helps not just poor people, but middle-class people as well. She's married in Bloomington. She has four kids. She has her cosmetology license. And just the health care costs for her kids, they hurt a lot. And so this is another way just to help ease that burden a little bit and help her make a living. My sister-in-law, who serves as a cosmetologist, she lives in Bloomington as well. They're looking at doing work on their house, and this extra money in her pocket, she says about 18% of her wages or how much money she earns at the end of the year comes from tips. This would help remodel her house and help improve her lifestyle. My sister, a few years ago, she was a single she's a single mother. She has three kids. She lives in West Bloomington, works in East Bloomington. And actually, she told me a story. I talked to her about this. Representative Lencheski, who once served on this committee, she said, you know, she left a really good tip. And, you know, some people say tips is, oh, it depends on how good you serve. But, you know, some people, they don't tip at all. It doesn't matter how good of a service you give. And with tips, it's not necessarily just a paid-for-service. You don't sign a contract for this. This isn't something you sign up for a salary. This is someone giving out of the goodness of their heart. It's sort of like a gift. At the federal level, gifts, they're not even taxed. But she told me a story about her mom, who also worked at the same restaurant. She actually lost money on her paycheck because the way the tax code is set up now is, someone can correct me, but about the government assumes that you're getting tipped, and they automatically take 8% out of your paycheck. She actually lost money because she didn't get any tips. Another person, Chad, who's a server at an Italian restaurant, and hopefully they're not watching, but he's looking at popping the question. This may be a good opportunity to help save some money. But I know a lot of Chads. So, Cindy, a grandmother who works with her single mom. I bowl in Bloomington at Southtown, and she works two jobs to help take care of her granddaughter. And these are just opportunities that we can help people that work every day without worrying about tax breaks to the upper 1% or however we want to word it. This helps everyday people that on average make $23,000 a year. And I think this would go a long way to help. So lastly, I just want to say this really shouldn't affect the service industry too much. There's not too much that they would really have to do. According to this bill, it just prevents tips from being taxable income.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Mr. Bickett? Okay, I have on my list here other testifiers, Dan McElroy from Minnesota Restaurant Association and Wayne Lundberg. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify on behalf of this bill or with concerns? Would the department like to testify?
Very briefly.
Okay. Oh, you can take as long as you want. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Dan McElroy. I'm Executive Vice President of the Minnesota Restaurant Association. Our thanks to Representative Drozdowski for raising this issue and to the testifier to talk about the great men and women who work in our industry, often in tipped positions. I do have a couple of technical concerns. If we're reading the bill correctly, it authorizes a subtraction in 2018, but authorizes employers to adjust withholding in 2020. If this moves ahead, we got to reconcile those things. There is also a comment in the revenue note about level of compliance with the tip recording requirement. I think historically that has been accurate, but it's changing dramatically as more and more of our guests pay by credit card and debit card, and the fastest growing form of payment is mobile pay on phones. Burger King told me several weeks ago that now more than 50% of their quick service volume is on cards or mobile pay. Table service restaurants, it's approaching 90% in many cases, a little more so in the metro area than in greater Minnesota, but the ability to track tips is greater. We hope that this provokes a discussion about tips more broadly. When I came to the Restaurant Association 7.5 years ago, about 50% of the volume in the restaurant industry was at table service, which is where the better tipping jobs are. There are certainly tips now at coffee shops and fast casual. They aren't large tips. They reflect the testifier's kind of level of income. However, we did a survey of 110 locations in Minneapolis for October of 2016, and they ranged from Perkins and the malt shop and some counter service, low average check restaurants up through the steakhouses and high average check. We were pleased to see that our kitchen workers are making more than the minimum wage, but still not a lot, about $13 an hour. And the average tipped employee at 110 locations made $28.16 in tips. They don't work 40 hours. They work between 25 and 30 hours in those positions, but they're still good jobs. We're concerned that if the pressure, tips now count as income, they count for workers' comp, they count for unemployment, they don't count for the minimum wage. There's a national momentum to recognize tips more. Hawaii passed a tip recognition law for the first time in 2016. Maine repassed their tip recognition law in 2017. The Seattle City Council included tips on a somewhat limited basis and with a sunset in 2023. But I think we're understanding that tips are real money, and we thank Representative Drozdowski for raising the question, how can we protect good-paying tip jobs going forward without penalizing those who just earn a few tips? We'll have some ideas on that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Drozdowski.
Questions for Mr. McElroy? Thank you very much. Mr. Lundberg?
I'll pass it to the Chair.
Okay. I think we go, anyone with concerns, we go to the department then. Welcome to the committee, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I do not have additional cookies for Representative Drozdowski. But I was able to send a note to Representative Drozdowski yesterday. The bill allows a subtraction for tip income for individuals beginning in tax year 2018 and removes the requirement of withholding Minnesota income tax from tips for payroll periods after December 31st of 2019. From an administrative perspective, it's important to know that the department would not have the information on the amount of tips received by an individual and could not substantiate the subtraction amounts an individual would possibly take. In addition, although the requirement to withhold income tax from tip income received as wages begins in 2020, the subtraction from the individual income tax begins in 2018. This may result in over-withholding from employees' regular pay that will need to be refunded in 2018 and 2019. The subtraction of tip income begins for tax year 18, however, will continue to withhold until 2020. Finally, I just wanted to note that this is a major deviation from how we currently treat income. It would also be a substantial deviation from the federal withholding requirements. While we have many Minnesota-only subtractions that exempt various items from the income tax, this would be the first major deviation from the withholding tax, potentially causing frustration and confusion for tax payers and tax preparers. This means that employers would then have to keep separate withholding records and thresholds for the federal government and state government. If this bill moves through the process, Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you and Chair Drazkowski and staff. We appreciate the opportunity to come before the committee today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Any questions for the department? Mr. Cummings, Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, Mr. McElroy raised the issue, but I'm wondering if you can speak more. What impact would this have on tipped employees' unemployment insurance compensation? Were they to be laid off? And what effect would it have on their workers' comp, if any, if they're injured on the job?
Mr. Cummings.
Would it negatively affect them?
I don't know the answer to that question. Maybe Mr. Williams or Mr. Michael could.
Mr. Williams or Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dabney, I don't think the income taxability of this income would have any effect on the coverage under those programs, although I'm not knowledgeable about workers' comp or unemployment comp, but that would be my instinct.
Chair Dabney.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, General.
Representative Hertogs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummins, as I listened to the testimonies about tipped income, is there a statutory definition of what a tip is? Is there any prohibition from tipping any other type of employee that provides a service? Or what would be the differentiation between a tip and a bonus?
Mr. Cummings?
I think I'll let Mr. Michael further expound on this, but there is a definition of what income is. And within that definition of an income, it does specify tips. So and I think Mr. Michael will know probably the whole definition of what income is, so I will defer to Mr. Michael.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hertas, the Representative Drazkowski's bill references definitions in federal law that apply to specifically reporting tipped income, and so the subtraction would be tied to those federal definitions for reporting tipped income. And so a bonus that's paid by the employer would not be considered a tip under the bill.
Representative Hertas?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I'm interested in what the impact would be on things like retirement. The reason I raise that question, when we talk about tipped income, we often talk about the restaurant industry because that's where the greatest number of employees are. But there are other occupations that, where you have tips as part of the income. And I'll use my father, who's long ago been deceased, but he was a tipped employee working for the railroad. And he used to say somewhat tongue-in-cheek, he would say, we have the lowest pay scale on the entire railroad, but we have among the highest seniority list. In other words, the tips were very good. But when he retired, his railroad retirement was based on his actual income, not including the tips. And so I would argue that he made very good money when he was raising five children because of the tips. But when he retired, my mother and my father did pay a price in the sense that they had a lower retirement because of the way the railroad retirement was calculated. So I just put that on the table as a personal anecdote, if you will,
that you have to look at all occupations that might be subject to tips and also look at what the income might be on various fringe benefits and retirement and so on. Now, railroad retirement is somewhat similar to Social Security, but it is different. It's a different retirement system in its entirety, but it is based on your I don't remember if it was kind of like public employees with a high five or career average or what it was, but I think it may have been a career average.
Thank you, Chair Carlson. Any other questions for the department or the author?
Well, Mr. I did have a question in that if anybody had looked, if the author or anybody had looked at the impact on retirement, is my point in terms of advocating for the bill. I mean, you have people who work for hotels that may be the doorman, you know, or they may be parking cars. There are all kinds of occupations that are subject to tip income, and often the employer kind of assumes that you're going to have a certain amount of income based on the tips. The man or woman who might work at a hat check situation in a restaurant or some other place. I mean, there's just a ton of different occupations, is my point. And so I think you have to look at things like the biggest one would probably be retirement, at least from my understanding.
Chair Drazkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe Mr. Michael can correct me if I'm wrong, but I understand that the way the bill is written, the tipped income is still viewable to the IRS and the Department of Revenue. We simply remove the tax or actually provide a subtraction for the tax on that. And so it shouldn't, there should still be full transparency of the amount of tip income earned, as I understand it.
Mr. Chairman, the IRS is one thing. You know, my father always had to report his tip income to the IRS. But the way railroad retirement was calculated, that was a different question. That was based on your actual wages. And so being the lowest paid employees working for the railroad, in my example there, they got a smaller pension under railroad retirement. Tips were not counted as part of their income for retirement purposes. That's a different question than the IRS. He was always very careful to report his income to the IRS, and I assume to the state of Minnesota as well.
Chair Drazkowski. Or Mr. Cummings?
Well, if I could, Mr. Chair. Chair Drazkowski. I think it's also a different question than this bill, but maybe Mr. Michael can answer it.
Mr. Michael?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, it's hard for me to conceive how this bill will have much effect on participation in or the amount that's put into retirement savings. I suppose it could in this sense. But first of all, I would say almost all tipped employees, probably very few tipped employees are in, you know, old-fashioned defined benefit pension plans. You're right that to the extent railroad employees like, you know, Pullman porters and that kind of thing, yeah, I suppose there are some of those, and they have their own defined benefit system that replicates Social Security and a private pension, and none of that's going to be affected by any of this. Most people in the service industry, I would guess, are either in 401k plans or have no retirement plan at all and have to save on their own in their own IRAs. What this bill does is simply reduce their Minnesota income tax on that. You could conceive, I suppose, that that may lead somebody to mistakenly not contribute as much to their IRA or their 401k as they otherwise would. It's probably equally plausible that now they have more disposable income, and so they may increase their contributions to their 401k and so have more retirement security. So I'm not sure. I don't think this really probably will affect very much the retirement.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that's why I raised the question if anybody had looked at that aspect, although I'll have to think that through. Social Security is based on, in part, your benefits on your income. So depending on how that income is calculated is my point, and I don't want to belabor the question. It was basically my question was, would there be an impact on retirement for some occupations?
Mr. Mike.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Carlson, that we can sort of respond more directly to, because this bill simply exempts the state income tax, the FICA tax, which will determine what your Social Security, your AMI, AME is, will be unaffected by this. And so the FICA tax will still be paid, and it will be in your Social Security earnings record, and these tipped employees will get the same Social Security benefits.
Mr. Chairman, that answers the question then. That would answer my concern then, that that would not be a negative impact on retirement. Thank you.
Okay. I think we've got this. We're good. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Cummings. You want to wrap it up there, Chair Raskowski? We have another bill to get through here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Great bill. It would amount to about 10% of the current biennium's projected over-collection of people's money, and it would impact people who work very hard, and we could provide some additional incentive, too, by letting them keep more of their money. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Raskowski. Chair Raskowski renews his motion that House File Number 2833 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Item next. Thank you, Chair Raskowski. Item next, Chair Garofalo moves House File 486.
Mr. Chairman, I have an A2 amendment.
Okay, we have an author's amendment. Chair Garofalo moves the H0486 A2 amendment. Discussion? Hearing none, all favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. We now have House File 486 in the shape the author would like as amended. So I have three testifiers, Corey Parnell, Amber Shimpa, David Sage. Is there anyone else wish to testify on behalf of the bill? Anyone else wish to testify with concerns? Does the department wish to testify?
Not at this time, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Chair Garofalo, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House File 486 is amended. Allows businesses that are legal in the state of Minnesota to take the same tax deductions on their state income taxes, business taxes, as do other lawful businesses in the state of Minnesota. Quite simply, it makes sense. If you take a look at what is happening in terms of the cost being imposed in these industries, again, this industry, the medical cannabis, medical marijuana industry, is a legal business in the state of Minnesota. It allows them to have the same deductions as other businesses. And, Mr. Chairman and members, I know today is kind of our, you know, state opioid day here at the Capitol. I do think it's important to point out the Minnesota Department of Health last night released a study. It was embargoed until 1 a.m. That actually shows the effect that medical marijuana has had on those who are qualifying as a qualifying condition of intractable pain. And it's right here in the Star Tribune. It's right on the front page. You can read about it. And what it says is that over 60%, 60, of those people who are taking medical marijuana as an alternative lesson are able to eliminate or reduce their opioid usage. Over 60%. And as a policy outcome, I don't think there's any Republicans or Democrats, liberal or conservative, could view that as anything other than a 100% positive outcome for the state of Minnesota, especially given the destruction we're seeing as a result of opioid abuse in our state and around the nation. So it's a pretty cut and dried bill. I have some testifiers here from the businesses to talk about that, but I would ask for member support and would happy to stand for questions at the conclusion of their testimony. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Garofalo. Why would you embargo something till 1 a.m.? Is that kind of an odd time, or is that normal?
Mr. Chairman, I believe I got the report because I'm on the Medical Marijuana Council, and they sent it out about 11 p.m., and so just it's set on their embargo until 1 a.m., so I'm just repeating what it said on there. But I would encourage members to get a hold of it and read it. I mean, the data is overwhelming. Not only do the vast majority of patients who are suffering from it, I don't mean to turn this into a health hearing, but those who are suffering from intractable pain discuss the fact that they are experiencing far more comfort, they're sleeping better, that they're living a better quality of life as a result of this. We're seeing dramatic reductions in opioid use.
Okay, thank you, Chair Garofalo. Corey Parnell, CPA.
for some CPA firm there. Please state who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, representatives. My name is Corey Parnell. I'm a CPA, Beckerman graduate, mayor. I've been a CPA in St. Paul for over 30 years. One of our clients that we work with is Minnesota Medical Solutions. And one of the things is the state of Minnesota did pass medical marijuana. However, the federal government continues to see it as a Schedule I controlled substance. So what that really means to the company in meeting its filing requirements is a 280E limitation on deduction of expenses. So, for example, they're not allowed to deduct pharmaceutical salaries, dispensary rent, dispensary utilities, and other general operating expenses. The only thing they're allowed to deduct is cost of sales. That's what I have at this time. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Parnell? Thank you. I have next Amber Shimpa, Minnesota Medical Solutions. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning, and thank you, Chairman and representatives, for providing me the opportunity to offer this testimony. My name is Amber Shimpa. I am the Chief Financial Officer for Minnesota Medical Solutions, one of the two licensed medical cannabis manufacturers in the state of Minnesota. My professional background is banking, and I've been involved in all financial matters for MinMed, including taxation and audits, since its inception. Minnesota Medical Solutions is proud to see the Minnesota Medical Program continue to grow, and we are very encouraged by the number of chronic pain patients who can reduce or discontinue use of dangerous and addictive opioid medications by switching to cannabis medications. But cost remains a top concern relayed by our patients across the state, and for many Minnesotans, our medications simply are too expensive, despite our best efforts to keep them affordable through competitive, compassionate discounts and our loyalty programs. The reasons for the costs are high are many, including the fact that health insurance does not cover the costs of medical cannabis. Therefore, all of our patients, must cover the full cost of these products out of pocket. Moreover, while Minnesota's medical cannabis program is growing, the relatively low number of enrolled patients makes it difficult for us operators to achieve economies of scale in production. It should be noted that neither cannabis manufacturer in the state has generated a profit, and both have suffered substantial losses in every year of operation. But there is another layer to the cost equation, as Mr. Parnell indicated, the very unusual tax treatment of medical cannabis manufacturers in Minnesota. IRS Section 280E, is a federal tax regulation, prevents cannabis companies from deducting expenses from their income, except those for considered costs of goods sold. Thus, we are not able to deduct the many standard expenses that those in every other industry can, like rent or marketing and certain payroll expenses. This dramatically drives up our combined state and federal taxation rates. In fact, our tax rate is nearly 70%. Let me repeat that. Our effective tax rate is nearly 70%. This is by far the highest tax rate that any Minnesota corporation pays, and enough to cause just about any business to shut its doors. But as can be expected, we unfortunately are forced to pass the exorbitant costs of these taxes onto our patients, making Minnesota's medical cannabis prices among some of the highest in the nation. While the Minnesota legislature cannot change federal tax law, it does have the authority to amend state tax law. And we are therefore hopeful that a relatively straightforward change in Minnesota law will allow us to deduct standard business expenses from our Minnesota state corporate taxes, resulting in substantial savings for the company. Simply put, savings on the tax bill would translate to savings for our patients. To be clear, we're not asking for special treatment here, just standard treatment as a state-licensed legal business operating in the state of Minnesota. We are not asking you to set up a precedent here of being the first state to enact tax fairness for their state medical cannabis businesses. Other states do allow for the medicinal use of cannabis have set up and taken this step, and we're hopeful that more states tackle this issue there will eventually be change to the federal tax code. And I would like to make one additional comment. Today is Opioid Day at the Capitol, and the families who have lost loved ones to opioid addiction and overdoses are here today to talk with their legislators about the need for Minnesota to take action to address this crisis. Medical cannabis can be a part of that solution to opioids. Chronic pain was added as a qualifying condition in August of 2016, and since then, we have served thousands of patients from all across the state seeking an alternative to the addictive and dangerous opioids they are using. Pain patients are very aware of the risks they take by using highly addictive medications, but they often have no alternatives until now. And as I said earlier, we are encouraged by the number of chronic pain patients who have come to MnMed seeking an opioid alternative. About two-thirds of our pain patients have either reduced their opioid medication use significantly or stopped altogether. Passage of this legislation would help us reduce our costs to our patients. It would be a major step forward in addressing the scourge of opioid addiction. Thank you for allowing me to testify, and be happy to answer any questions regarding the 280E tax issue at hand. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Chimpa? Thank you very much. Now we'll go to Mr. Dave Sage. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dave Sage. I am the CFO at Leafline Labs. I'll keep this very short. We 100% agree with my colleague here. We just would like to be treated as any other business and avoid having to give our investors a tax bill at the same time we're losing money. That's really all I have to say. Thank
you. Any questions for Mr. Sage? Okay, if you'd like to wrap it up, Chair Grapple. Oh, I'm sorry, Chair Marquardt.
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And this will ultimately probably be a question for Mr. Michael, but medical cannabis is legal in Minnesota, but it's still a violation of federal law. And we know Article 6 of the Constitution, the Supremacy Clause, is federal law, still trumps state law. And President Trump's administration has taken a different stance, more of a hands-on approach to this regarding the states that have legalized this and recreational marijuana compared to President Obama's administration that kind of had a hands-off. So I guess the question is, Mr. Michael, do we have any other credit or deduction in our tax code towards or benefiting an activity that's a violation of federal law?
Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chairman, not that I'm aware of. The one thing I would say, though, is that this 280E provision is sort of a unique, unusual provision. It might be useful for people to understand the history of how that came about. And that's essentially there was a tax court case that the IRS lost back in the late 70s or early 80s where I'm not sure it was some sort of illegal drug business that they assessed tax on, and the taxpayer in that case said, well, I am entitled to deduct my business expenses, and the tax court agreed, and then Congress was outraged, and they enacted 280E. And so this category of illegal activity is treated differently in some ways than other illegal activity in the sense that, you know, I think if you're in, like, bookmaking or something like that, you are allowed to deduct your business expenses, but not these folks. So that it's a very quirky kind of area. And Minnesota also has this controlled substance tax that was enacted in response to the Latimer Tax Study Commission that for a while we were collecting some revenues under that sort of says we'll impose a sumptuary tax on dealings in these things. So this is a very quirky kind of area.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's a concern for me, so thank you.
Other questions for the author or testifiers? I'd like to wrap it up, Chair Grapple.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the hearing and members of the committee. I think this is a real common sense thing that we can do. If any members of the committee have concerns, please feel free to reach out to me. Happy to work with you on this, but I do think this is a way to provide more compassionate care to people and to do it in a way by just simply applying uniform. It's a tax conformity issue, Mr. Chairman.
Just got a lot more complex.
Thank you, Mr.
Nonconformity.
Conformity to me.
Chair Garofalo renews his motion that House File 46 as amended be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. For that, members, thank you very much. A lot of good testimony today. Look for your emails to see what we're doing next week, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. With that being said, good government all the time. We are adjourned.
See how